Thank you very much for the nice introduction, and thank you for accommodating both the time difference and also the joint meeting. I know Neil and Nyesh had a bit of a headache dealing with the time change. Now, if there is a significant delay, if you have questions, please just use the hand raising or raise your hand nice and early, and I will try to answer smoothly. Okay, so yeah, so again, it's a great pleasure to be here, and today I want to talk about some work that we've been doing recently and also in the last couple of years that has to do with, broadly speaking, with black holes in cosmological settings, thermodynamics, various semi-classical models that we're studying, observational signatures that we're looking for. Perhaps the abstract is a little bit more honest than the title, so hopefully you read that. And I will assume, because I think we have quite a variety of people in different backgrounds, I haven't assumed too much about prior knowledge on these subjects. And there is quite a bit to get through, so I won't necessarily be able to go into enormous amounts of detail. But my goal will be to generate discussion and interest in the topics that I'm going to talk about and the kind of work that I do, and hopefully everybody can find at least something there that they find interesting and useful. So I will break up the talk into two different parts. So the first will be about black hole thermodynamics, what it tells us about black holes and gravity in general. What we can learn about phase transitions of black holes, both in analogous systems and through holographic settings. And something that's been really important to me is understanding how we can generalize things that we've learned about black hole thermodynamics to De Sitter spaces and more cosmologically relevant spaces, where there are a lot of technical difficulties and conceptual difficulties. That make that both exciting, important, but also quite a difficult thing to study. So that's the first part. And then in the second part, I will talk about various semi-classical models of black holes, and I will present a framework that we use to try to understand different models of black holes. Can we understand them in cosmological settings? Which dynamical models of black holes are viable, which are not? And can we extract some observational signatures of various features of these models? So, of course, to this group and in this setting, I don't really need to say, but I'll say it anyways, why we study black holes and why they're so interesting. So, as you well know, they're one of the few places in the universe where the scales are such that we can access quantum gravity effects and semi-classical effects. Really, the only other place is the very early universe, and we see many signatures and relics of semi-classical and quantum effects from there. But in the present day, it's really black holes. And for a long time, we've known that since they seem to possess these thermodynamic properties, temperature, entropy, and so on, which are usually associated to a coarse graining of some description of microscopic degrees of freedom of a system. They really tell us something about the fundamental constituents, if you will, of gravity, presumably. In any case, we've learned a great many things. Whether or not you believe that the objects that you see in the sky are really the black holes that are described by the classical metrics that we use or not. And so from a theoretical point of view, they're very interesting, and increasingly from an observational point of view, because now we can image these things close to the horizon scale. And in the coming years and decades, observational technology is going to become even more powerful. And so we really need to understand what these models are and how we can best describe them, what we can learn from them. So I briefly review for those who maybe aren't familiar, the laws of black hole thermodynamics. So black hole systems, classical black hole solutions to general relativity, obey a first law that looks very much like the ordinary first law of thermodynamics. This was observed exactly 50 years ago by Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking, and Bekenstein provided the relationship between the entropy and the area of a black hole, which, unlike most systems, does not scale with the volume of the system. And you can incorporate matter as they did in their original paper in various ways. So the variation of the total mass or energy of the space-time is given by the heat term, kappa dA, which is TdS, plus various variations to do with the other conserved quantities that describe the classical solution. And then, of course, if you have matter as well, you will have some volume integrals over the matter stress tensor if it's present in the space-time. Can I just ask, can you see the mouse on the screen when I move it around? If I use it as a pointer, you can. Yes or no?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. Right. So you can readily incorporate matter, although note that usually we require an equilibrium description, which limits kind of the applications to real systems where you can understand this thing, because you're looking for stationary solutions where you don't have heat fluxes and things like this if you want an equilibrium description. Now, we have a more modern covariant formulation of the first law, which really reveals the role of diffeomorphisms in its construction. So it really is a much more general constraint on the parameters that describe a classical solution. This was observed by Liewald, Iyer, Zupas just 20, 30 years ago. That really black hole entropy, classical black hole entropy, is really about diffeomorphism invariance, general relativity. So in general, it's always the case, Hamilton's equations, that the variation of a Hamiltonian associated with the symmetry of the flow is given by some integral of a symplectic current over some hypersurface in your spacetime. But then, so this is always true, but then if this xi is really a diffeomorphism symmetry, and if your spacetime contains a Cauchy surface which has as a boundary a black hole event horizon, then really this variation takes the form of something that evaluates to the first law. So you have some conserved quantity q, another charge associated with the diffeomorphism, but these various boundary terms will give you respectively what is the ADM energy of the spacetime, what is the angular momentum of the spacetime, and on the left-hand side, a quantity which, when evaluated on the horizon, if this is a killing horizon, something which is the surface gravity times a variation of the entropy of that horizon. So classically, at least, we have a very nice understanding of what is black hole entropy. Of course, in the quantum case, things are much more open, and one of the biggest problems of quantum gravity, but also where we gain the most insights, is trying to understand how to reconstruct this microscopic entropy of black holes. And there have been various proposals and various successes over the years, which have been very nice, but to say that we have a complete answer would be a lie. Now, one more thing that I'll say is that even though usually we're dealing with stationary scenarios and equilibrium solutions, the first law does have a physical process-based interpretation in terms of actually, you know, throwing matter into a black hole. The way it was originally conceived by these thought experiments, how does the mass change when you throw something into it? This is a physical process, but as written here, really it's this global state comparison version that I've written, where you're comparing nearby stationary solutions that are labeled by different ADN masses, which of course is not going to change in a spacetime. It's something defined at infinity. Nonetheless, in generalizing to dynamical settings, there are various proposals for how this can be done with various successes. Most of the difficulty in generalizing to dynamical situations comes from defining the entropy. So if you imagine the horizon of a black hole, it traces out some world tube, the horizon generators, and no matter what cut of the horizon you take, the area that you evaluate, which gives you the entropy, it's independent of the choice of cross-section of the horizon, if it's stationary. But if you have an evolving horizon, then actually the entropy depends on your choice of foliation, and in this way, it's difficult to define entropy, although there are proposals for defining this dynamical entropy, which I won't get into here. One thing that I should say, though, is that perhaps it's not so widely known or widely appreciated, but nonetheless, it is true that the original derivation of Hawking radiation from the 70s, of course, assumed some stationary or static background that results from gravitational collapse of a black hole. An observer here near future time like infinity will observe a thermal density matrix that comes from these ingoing modes from past infinity, not the ones that fall into the horizon. If you have an ingoing mode that arrives too late with the collapsing matter, it's forever trapped. But the ones very near the horizon, and it's easier to see on the diagram on the right, these ingoing modes become exponentially redshifted and are observed in the asymptotic future as a thermal density matrix at the Hawking temperature. But importantly, this thermal density matrix depends only on this exponential redshifting of these ingoing modes, which is given by a relationship between the canonical affine parameter on scry minus and on scry plus. So this relationship between U and V being exponential is actually what gives you the Hawking radiation. And you can see in any textbook example where these Bogle-Yubov coefficients are computed relating the state at past infinity and future infinity, that really the coefficient just depends on this function U of V. And if it is approximately exponential, then you will observe a Hawking flux, which is what we associate with the temperature of a black hole. And in a nice paper here, they showed that you don't even need a horizon to ever form in order for this to be the case. It suffices to have a dynamical scenario where you just have an apparent horizon and this approximately exponential relationship, you will still observe a Hawking flux. So I point this out to say that we have good reason to believe that these laws of thermodynamics are, even though they're formulated usually for these stationary solutions, that they really are somehow of relevance to real physical solutions where you might not expect a horizon to ever form at all, depending on your philosophy. So now let me talk about, first, if I'm going to talk about de Sitter eventually, I should talk about anti-de Sitter first. Because in some ways it's much simpler. Anti-de Sitter space, that's with negative cosmological constant, has some very nice features which are good for studying black hole thermodynamics. And the nice feature is that it has an effective potential which essentially confines radiation. So orbits, geodesics in asymptotically de Sitter spaces are all periodic with some frequency, well, all the same frequency actually, whether they're time-like or null. And so you can reach the conformal boundary of anti-de Sitter in finite value of the affine parameter. And what it means for a black hole is that while a black hole radiates via Hawking radiation and will eventually evaporate, but in anti-de Sitter space, if a black hole is sufficiently large, and by large we mean at least as large as the anti-de Sitter length scale, then the black hole will persist long enough for its Hawking radiation to reach the boundary and return and get reabsorbed. Okay, so a large black hole can be in equilibrium with its own Hawking radiation if the spacetime is asymptotically anti-de Sitter. If the black hole is very small, of course this won't happen because it will simply evaporate before any radiation returns, and there's a natural length scale that separates these two phenomena. So immediately now, if we're talking about thermodynamics and the presence of a cosmological constant, one can ask whether or not actually varying the cosmological constant is possible, whether or not it enters into the first law at all. So treated as a constant, of course it doesn't. So in thermodynamics, you write the total mass or the total energy of your system as some function of these independent extensive state variables, and its variation will give you a variation, a term that corresponds to the variation of each of these independently variable thermodynamic parameters. with some conjugate potential. So in this case, it's the entropy, the angular momentum, or the charge, along with its conjugate variables, which are the temperature or the potential. Of course, if lambda is a constant, then no such term appears here. But if you do allow it to vary, you can study what happens to a variation of the total mass or energy of the spacetime. This was done in the early 2000s by Castor, Ray, Trashin. And an extra term appears in the first law that looks like this theta delta lambda, a variation which, when integrated, actually this theta, this conjugate potential, it's a surface integral, these Komar quantities, which evaluate to the infinite volume of anti-de Sitter space subtracted by the infinite volume of the black hole anti-de Sitter space evaluated from the horizon to infinity. So the net result is that this killing potential evaluates to the volume of the black hole, or the volume that is excluded from the anti-de Sitter space by the presence of the black hole. So in the first law, a variation of lambda, if you allow it to vary, gives you a term that's like V delta P. So this is like a pressure, which is identified with minus the cosmological constant. This is very nice because in the ordinary laws of thermodynamics, of course, you know you have the variation of the internal energy is a heat term TdS minus PdV. So this term is plus VdP, which looks a little strange, but really it's because the left-hand side corresponds to a variation of enthalpy and not the variation of the internal energy of your system. So if you vary the enthalpy of an ordinary thermodynamic system, which is just the internal energy plus the amount of work required to create the black hole or to displace a given amount of volume, which in this case is given by the black hole volume, then you get exactly a relation like this, TdS plus VdP. So I should point out that there are mechanisms which allow, obviously in cosmology and in string theory and many other examples, which allow lambda to vary. However, you can treat it as a constant, and there are still many interesting things to study and to learn, even if you don't treat lambda as a variable. So let me talk about phase transitions, especially in anti-de Sitter space, because this is where they are most well studied and most well known. So what can happen, as I described earlier, is in ADS space, you can have a black hole. If it's very small, it will simply evaporate. If it's very large, it can come into equilibrium with its own radiation. And the separation between these two behaviors occurs at some critical size of the black hole, which corresponds to some critical temperature as given by the Hawking temperature, which is a little bit different in anti-de Sitter than it is in asymptotically flat space. And so you can imagine that a phase transition would occur if you could tune the temperature of the spacetime, just increase the amount of radiation sufficiently. At some point, there will be enough radiation that it will simply coalesce into a black hole, which is then settles down into an equilibrium at the given temperature. And the way that you can see it explicitly is just by computing the free energy of these different states. So the free energy of radiation is approximately zero. And the free energy of the black hole, which is just the mass minus T times the entropy, you can directly compute it and compare it for dominance in the partition function relative to the empty ADS radiation phase. And what you find is two branches of solution. So the size of the black hole is increasing in the direction of this arrow. So you have an unstable branch here. You'll notice the heat capacity of this phase is negative, but you have a stable branch of large black holes, which above a certain temperature globally minimize the free energy. So they represent the dominant contribution to the partition function for gravity and anti-de Sitter space. This transition, this was observed in the 80s by Stephen Hawking and Don Page. This is the Hawking-Page transition. And it occurs fairly generically in any kind of anti-de Sitter space, but also, as we'll see, in asymptotically flat and de Sitter space times. So this occurs whether or not you consider variable lambda, but I want to point out that when you
can I ask a question, Phil? Why is energy for radiation zero?
It's not exactly zero, okay? Usually you normalize it to zero because, so this large black hole phase extends all the way down to minus infinity. So regardless of the normalization of the free energy or for the radiation phase, which is set by whatever subtraction term you pick when you compute, for example, the Euclidean action, you will still have this Hawking page transition occur, but you can actually compute the free energy of the radiation. And the point is that in the context of ADS CFT, the free energy of the radiation is like order one, if you actually compute it with quantum corrections, but the free energy of the black hole phase goes like order n or n squared. And so when n, for large n, this will always dominate over the radiation, at least at tree level. When you're at one loop and things, there are corrections, but for the most part, this is approximately zero in any kind of realistic computation. Nonetheless, that only matters if you have an uncharged black hole. So if the black hole has some charge and you're in the canonical ensemble where the charge is fixed, looking on the diagram on the left, you cannot transition to this empty radiation phase, which would have zero charge. That's just the empty anti-de Sitter spacetime if you're in a canonical ensemble because the charge is fixed. So instead, you have a transition between a small and a large black hole that occurs at some other value of the free energy. And this state is no longer relevant to the ensemble. But what I was saying is that if you do have variable lambda, you have this very nice analogy between these black hole phase transitions and ordinary fluid systems. So this was observed by Rob and David. I think it was back in 2012 for Reisner and Nordstrom ADS, but there's a nice review here from 2016. And actually for Reisner and Nordstrom anti-de Sitter black holes, you can draw phase diagrams, and the behavior near the critical point is exactly the same as it is and the general behavior for ordinary fluid systems like van der Waals fluids. So having variable lambda introduces a notion of pressure into your thermodynamic description, which allows you to kind of make contact and analogies with ordinary thermodynamic systems, where of course you have an equation of state, P is a function of E or T or V, something else like this. If you don't have variable lambda, there is no notion of pressure for the space-time. And so you don't have an equation of state in the usual sense. Nonetheless, the kinds of transitions that are relevant for holography, like the Hawking page transition, do still occur. And so it is interesting to study these transitions, whether or not you have variable lambda. Just a brief reminder of how this works for anti-de Sitter space. You know, here we're on the Euclidean ADS, but essentially you have a region of ADS which is small compared to the ADS length scale that is like Minkowski. So that's where the black holes will simply evaporate, and then the large ones really feel the presence of the curvature of ADS, and those are the ones that are stable. And anti-de Sitter space is very nice for holography because you have this boundary which is time-like, and you can take the boundary stress tensor. You can take the stress tensor in the bulk and compute it at the boundary and find that that in fact this is the stress tensor of a conformal field theory. So you know the Brown-York quasi-local stress tensor here becomes the renormalized expectation value of the stress tensor of the CFT. These are treated as functionals of this boundary metric. And so this is very nice. And you can ask, you know, to what extent is the bulk gravitational physics can actually be mapped to some boundary theory? And the answer is to quite a large extent. As many of you will know, essentially the statement is that the partition function for gravity in the bulk is the same as the partition function for a conformal field theory at the boundary. In fact, more strongly stated, the Hilbert space of quantum gravity in bulk anti-de Sitter is the same as for the boundary conformal field theory. And in the bulk theory in ADS CFT, this is some typically some variety of supergravity theory in the large N limit. So not exactly the kind of theory that would describe QCD, for example, which for which N is equal to 3. But nonetheless, we can still learn a lot of interesting things by studying these CFTs, which have interpretations and important applications for condensed matter systems and different phenomena of strong coupling. Because when the bulk in ADS CFT is weakly coupled, then the boundary theory is strongly coupled and vice versa. So what's been known for some time now is that this transition in anti-de Sitter space in the bulk, the black hole anti-de Sitter solution transition to the radiation phase is dual to this deconfinement transition in supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory in the boundary, which is in one dimension lower. So by studying the phase structure of black hole solutions in, for example, ADS5, we can learn things about phenomena as strong coupling in the boundary theory in four dimensions relevant to physical situations. So I'm not just saying that it's interesting without providing an example, because over the years we've studied many systems in bulk ADS, Gauss-Bonnet gravity, Lovelock gravity, and so on. And what is the point? Well, if you take the Einstein-Hilbert action and you consider small corrections in the form of, for example, a Gauss-Bonnet term, then your black hole solutions also acquire corrections. And these have some holographic dual. So there is a well-known viscosity bound for quantum field theories, which is believed to be largely universal in terms of the ratio of the viscosity to the entropy density. But now if you study Gauss-Bonnet corrections to black hole solutions in the bulk, and you compute the behavior of these quantities at the boundary CFT, you find corrections to this universal viscosity bound for the boundary fluid, which is a four-dimensional system in this case. So it's of great interest to study all these bulk phenomena and try to learn what their interpretation is in terms of these boundary systems. But I really want to talk about de Sitter. So the difficulty in de Sitter is that a black hole will simply evaporate as it would in asymptotically flat space. So you don't have thermal equilibrium. There's no good way to define these asymptotic quantities that define the mass and so on, because you don't have a globally time-like killing vector field. And even in the static patch, you have two horizons which are at a different temperature, and there's radiation between them. There's some kind of heat flux. So immediately, you have all kinds of difficulties in generalizing to a cosmological setting. One thing you can think to do is to just fix the temperature at a boundary surrounding a black hole. And this is like a cavity. So you put the black hole inside of a fixed temperature thermal bath, and then the black hole can be at equilibrium, and you can study thermodynamics in the usual way. And the way to implement this was suggested by Gibbons and Hawking in the 70s through the Euclidean path integral. So the Euclidean path integral lets you compute the partition function for gravitational fields. We usually work in the semi-classical and the saddle point approximation, but the partition function is given by this integral over metrics or fields, which are periodic with some periodicity, which is the inverse temperature, over the Euclidean metrics in the case of gravity. And the dominant contribution to this partition function just comes from the classical solutions of the equations of motion. So you sum over all the classical metrics, which are their Euclidean sections, which are periodic with periodicity beta. And usually this is chosen to eliminate a conical singularity, which would be present at the horizon. So this inverse temperature has a specific value. And then you can just compute the Euclidean action and compute the mean thermal energy, entropy, free energy of the ensemble, and so on. And in the case of de Sitter, this would proceed not by integrating over the entire manifold, but by cutting the Euclidean section at some finite boundary, because if you don't, then you have some conical singularity here, which is eliminated by a particular choice of beta, But at the cosmological horizon, at the other end of the cigar, you have another conical singularity, which is eliminated at a different choice of beta, and you cannot get rid of them both. So your geometry is singular unless you just cut the Euclidean section. But that corresponds to just imposing boundary conditions on a finite radius surface in your space-time, which is this cavity. So this technique is very powerful, but hasn't been used very much for studying thermodynamics in De Sitter. Just to give you a recent example, we studied these regular black hole solutions in asymptotically De Sitter space, along with a student here at Macquarie, Ioannis Soroneidis. And these solutions are sourced by nonlinear electrodynamic theories. Depending on the choice of this parameter mu here, you can generate Hayward and Bardeen models of black holes, which are sourced by magnetic charge. These provide nice models of classical black hole solutions, which are regular at the center, which don't have a singularity. And so we studied these in De Sitter, but also in asymptotically flat space using this Euclidean path integral. In asymptotically flat and anti-De Sitter space, things look very much like the well-known cases in Reissner-Nordström. You have a small to large black hole transition. There's a critical point with mean field theory, critical exponents, and nothing much exciting happens there. But in the asymptotically De Sitter case, the transitions in the bulk are very different. So in the presence of a cavity, you now have two critical points. You have a small to large black hole transition along both of these branches, connecting the two critical points where the transition becomes second order. And then you have supercritical black hole phases above and below a certain value of the cosmological constant. And the free energy here is seen on the right as well. So this cusp will form as you increase the value of lambda, but then it will disappear again when lambda is sufficiently large. And the same thing happens with variations of the cavity size. So this is really interesting because you don't see these kinds of structures in asymptotically ADS space at all. This kind of compact transition that is bounded by two second order critical points. And you can imagine that perhaps new critical behavior emerges where these points meet. And this phase diagram possesses kind of features that you see in more exotic materials, FCC
Oh,
transition,
can I ask you a
non-terminal.
question, Phil? Can you
Yes,
hear me?
of course.
Yeah. Can you go back to the previous slide? So is the radius of your cavity a free parameter here, or what do you pick for the radius of the cavity?
Yeah, here the radius of the cavity is fixed, and it's always fixed. So that's where you cut off the Euclidean section. It's fixed somewhere between the cosmological horizon and the black hole horizon. But you can also vary it as a free parameter, and you would obtain a similar diagram if you fix lambda and you vary the size of the cavity. And that is important for cosmological applications. I'll mention that soon.
But
But yeah.
I guess the worry I have, the question I have is that what actually keeps the black hole at the center of the cavity, because it's an unstable equilibrium. So if it kind of moves a little bit, then it would just fall into the hits the
Well,
boundary.
this is why. Why is it? This is a stable equilibrium. This
Why
is
is it
stable.
unstable? Because I mean, the sitter is repulsive. I mean, ADS is attractive, so things would oscillate around the ADS, but the sitter is repulsive, so
Exactly. So that's exactly why we have to fix the temperature at the boundary of the cavity. So it's like you have a black hole and a heat bath, and you have fixed the temperature there, and you're keeping the black hole inside. So now it can be stable. The
no, but you're
temperature at
talking
the
about
cavity is stable.
thermodynamic instability. I'm talking about the dynamical instability, which is basically if you want to put something at the center of the sitter and then move it a little bit just because it has negative gravity, it pulls things away. So it's because it's because the gravitational field basically is pointing outwards
Right. So here I'm talking about thermodynamic stability. The physical stability against perturbations is that's an entirely separate question, which, yeah, you're right. This needs to be studied in each case in its own right for this kind of stability, because thermodynamic stability does not necessarily imply generic stability against perturbations, as you point out, and vice versa. Now, this is a stationary solution in the static patch, where you cut out the cosmological horizon anyways. But you're absolutely right. Now, if you start studying perturbations of this stationary solution, you would have to assess that for stability as well. But it's a bit outside the purview of this kind of research. Very good point to keep in mind. But nonetheless, what we find from the thermodynamic point of view is a much richer phase structure than what you see in ADS. And so we have studied many examples here using this Euclidean path integral of different bulk black hole solutions with scalar fields in Gauss-Bonnet gravity, with exotic horizon geometries, regular black holes. And we see an incredible wealth of phenomena here, which the next step is to really understand, do these have useful dual interpretations in holography? Because holography in De Sitter space is much more difficult than it is in ADS. The boundaries there are in the infinite future and the infinite past. And we don't have, there's a lot of interesting work being done, but we don't really have a very good understanding of holography in De Sitter, but we expect that these bulk transitions do have useful interpretations in terms of CFT states in DS CFT. In one recent example I saw, they computed De Sitter Hawking page transitions, which you saw in the previous slide, and these are dual to Hagedorn transitions in a particular class of CFTs in De Sitter. So I argue that this is very interesting to study, and there is still a lot that we can learn there, especially from the dual picture. In terms of cosmology, the CMB, you know, it's like a heat bath, but you can imagine like this cavity is that the black hole is embedded in, and this thing is at a temperature of 2.7 Kelvin. So what kind of black hole does this actually correspond with if it was in thermal equilibrium with a cavity at the CMB temperature? Well, this is a black hole that's 70 micrometers large and has 1% of the Earth mass as its mass. So in a physical cosmology, this cavity really cannot be used to kind of study thermal equilibrium with the CMB at least. Now, of course, in the future, the CMB will be a lot colder, but there is one issue, which is that if you're looking for these phase transitions in cosmological settings, the critical points usually occur when the black hole is of the order of the anti-De Sitter or the De Sitter length scale, which is very large indeed. So you wouldn't really expect not even supermassive black holes in the current cosmology to ever exhibit these kinds of phase transitions. The scales are completely wrong. However, in this cavity, you actually have Hawking page transitions occurring even when the cosmological constant is negligibly small. And one can wonder whether or not there are physical situations in the very early universe in the inflationary phase where the types of boundary conditions that this cavity realizes are actually present. And you can model the behavior of a black hole embedded in some kind of a heat bath or radiation fluid at a particular temperature and hope to find or exclude the possibility of these kinds of transitions in cosmological settings. But as I hope I've shown, it's interesting to study them even if they don't actually occur in our cosmology. So with that, let me transition to the second part, which is to return to this picture and say that this object here, well, this is not a picture of a horizon, nor is it a picture of a light ring, really. It's the shadow of a black hole. And this picture, which is one of the best current observations that we have of the physical reality of these black holes, can actually be described by many different models, not just the Schwarzschild metric or the Kerr metric, which we use when we're studying ADS CFT. But we have this entire zoo of models of compact objects which can be differentiated by their compactness relative to a real Schwarzschild black hole. You have black holes, which can be singular or non-singular in the center. You have a wide variety of ultra-compact objects with or without horizon. These are so compact that their light ring dynamics and the dynamics near the photon sphere, you know, they're the same as predicted by a Kerr or Schwarzschild metric. And then of course you have at the larger compactness, things like boson stars and neutron stars. Now, of course, each of these models has their own particular underlying construction. Some of them have issues with stability and so on, but because they're very similar at the horizon scale, and indeed objects at gravistars can be made arbitrarily compact close to the Schwarzschild solution, it becomes really important to differentiate between these different models. And so part of the research that I'm doing here is to really try to understand, in a semi-classical setting, how can we understand the difference between these models, which ones are viable, because this is becoming very observationally relevant in the current era. So the event horizon, as a definition of what constitutes a black hole, presents many different challenges. It's teleological, it's not something you can localize. It doesn't serve as a very good definition of a black hole in an operational sense. It also leads to, you know, several well-known paradoxes related to information loss and so on. So from our point of view, and as you'll be very familiar with in strong gravity community, you know, we use the concept of an apparent horizon, which is the boundary of the trapped region, as the definition of a black hole. And really for what we call a physical black hole, we want this apparent horizon to form in finite time according to a distant observer. So this is a physicality condition on the type of solution that you're using to describe a black hole metric. An apparent horizon which forms in finite time. And also a natural assumption is regularity at the apparent horizon. Okay. So the experience of infalling observers, no firewalls occur, any other kind of pathological behavior like that. Normally the apparent horizon is inside the event horizon, but this is not the case if the null energy condition is violated. So what we do is we say a black hole is something that has an apparent horizon that forms in finite time according to distant observers. So it's something that we can mortally see. And it's free of pathologies near the apparent horizon, which can be time-like if the black hole is evaporating by a Hawking radiation. So it's important that you have regularity there, because the apparent horizon can actually be outside the event horizon. Indeed, the event horizon may never form. If you take these two things as input ingredients in your construction, you can start to ask questions about what are the constraints on the allowed black hole models that have these features, finite formation time and regularity at the apparent horizon.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, how can the apparent horizon be time-like? I mean, if it's supposed to be inside the event horizon, and if the event horizon is evaporating, the apparent horizon will be shrinking with it, but it will always stay inside. So how can it be time-like?
Yeah, you can have a time-like apparent horizon, but it requires a violation of the null energy conditions. So for ordinary matter, the null energy condition is obviously satisfied, and exactly what you say is what always happens. But the null energy condition is violated in the case of Hawking radiation. It must be. And in that case, if the NEC is violated, you can actually have a time-like apparent horizon, and it can be outside of the event horizon. Of course, radiation from Hawking radiation is a very, very, I mean, it's not something that we can hope to detect even in the near future, and it's a very, very subdominant effect. But nonetheless, it is the case that it is possible in principle to have a time-like apparent horizon.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. So with this in mind, we work in the semi-classical framework. So the classical metric is sourced by the expectation value of some renormalized energy momentum tensor in some state. We don't make any assumptions about what the state is or what the form of T is, and it includes both classical and quantum contributions. And you assume a general form of the metric, in this case, a spherically symmetric metric with a time function and a metric like this in terms of the Misner-Sharp mass. And this encompasses a very large number of known models of black holes. It includes the Schwarzschild metric, Reissner-Nordström, Videa metrics, and you can generalize it to axial symmetry and describe Kerr metrics and so on. And by imposing finite formation time of the apparent horizon and regularity at the apparent horizon, you can really constrain the form of this energy momentum tensor. Okay, it has to take on a very specific form if you want those two things to be true. And furthermore, the dynamics of these black holes, this is the dynamical metric, are highly constrained by the requirements of finite formation time and regularity. So what we do is introduce some rescaled components of the energy momentum tensor. This is understood to be the expectation value. And on the right-hand side, these are the equivalent Einstein equations. And then finiteness of the curvature invariance, or regularity, is imposed by the finiteness of these invariant quantities here. So F goes to zero at the apparent horizon. So if you don't want any divergences, then this restricts the scaling behavior of the components of the energy momentum tensor near the apparent horizon. Okay, these components have to scale like F to the power of K, and they have to do so in a certain way if these quantities are to not diverge. And so it turns out then that if you want these quantities to be finite at the apparent horizon, K can be zero or it can be equal to one. And then you can expand both the metric function and the energy momentum tensor near the apparent horizon. So we work in a near horizon expansion. X here is the distance to the apparent horizon. And regularity and finite formation time then constrain the form of the metric near the apparent horizon. This is the Misner-Sharp function, the time function, which is given, this is given by your choice of foliation, and the dynamics, RG prime. This is understood to be a derivative with respect to time. And you can see that the metric function depends on these quantities here, you know, E2, gamma xi, which are components of the energy momentum tensor in the near horizon expansion. So you have constraints for these forms, which is not precise values. But here is the TR block of the energy momentum tensor at the apparent horizon. It takes on this form, with gamma being some positive quantity, positive function of time. And this energy momentum tensor generically violates the null energy condition. So which types of metrics are consistent with this? Well, the Videa metrics, but there's four of those. You can have ingoing and outgoing Videa metrics, decreasing and increasing mass. And only two of those metrics are valid. The only two metrics which are valid are the ingoing Videa metric with decreasing mass as a function of V, and the outgoing Videa metric with increasing mass. So for black holes, the outgoing Videa metric, you know, in these UR coordinates describes white holes. The one of physical interest is the ingoing Videa metric, which describes then with decreasing mass, an evaporating black hole. So this evaporating black hole, you know, it violates the null energy condition. This is required for Hawking radiation to occur. But the expanding black hole solution is not actually allowed. So in spherical symmetry, the requirements of finite formation time and regularity of the apparent horizon actually do not allow a growing black hole solution described by, for example, the Videa metric. Right, so which of course is not an issue for cosmology because black holes are not spherically symmetric, but it is just to point out that the assumption of spherical symmetry in a semi-classical setting can actually have significant consequences for the dynamic of the allowed models. In a recent paper, we studied the curve idea metric, which is a rotating model of an evaporating black hole. So now you have M being a decreasing function of V, but you also have rotation. And we find that if you want regularity of the apparent horizon and finite formation time, actually all four Bayesian metrics are viable models of physical black holes near the apparent horizon, I always emphasize. And furthermore, we show that you can actually provide an exactly solvable model of these metrics in an asymptotically de Sitter space. And this is very interesting because, you know, we have exact classical solutions with arbitrary Robertson-Walker asymptotics with dynamical mass, which are spinning, which are regular, you know, which have a de Sitter core, but there are no known solutions which actually have all of these properties put together. No known classical solutions which have all of these properties. We've shown that you can provide an exactly solvable model like this in de Sitter. We've also shown that you can do it for curve idea for the rotating case. The job now is to hope to combine these two and use this rotating curve idea, which is asymptotically de Sitter, to probe some dynamical semi-classical effects of physical black holes. Let me just quickly back up here and point out one thing, because you might question up here, is T mu new? So this is supposed to be the classical matter plus the quantum corrections, and which normally come with a factor of H bar. So you might ask, well, wait a minute, don't semi-classical effects are going to be negligible compared to the dominant classical contributions here? But you know, in the general case, it's almost impossible to compute the renormalized expectation value of T mu nu in a semi-classical setting explicitly, exactly. And much more difficult to then use it in an iterative approach to actually solve the full semi-classical equations. But there are cases where you have massless scalar fields with conformal symmetry, where the form of this energy momentum tensor, the semi-classical energy momentum tensor, is known exactly. And in those examples, there are examples for dynamical black holes where the quantum contributions are not negligible near the apparent horizon at all. In fact, there are some cases where they dominate the dynamics of the black hole. So even though at the outset you would expect quantum corrections to be very small, we have reason to believe that they at least may be important at the horizon scale. And so that's why it's important to study these metrics in this kind of way where we don't distinguish between the classical and the quantum parts. So we have a few models, and development of these semi-classical models is ongoing. But what I'm really interested in the imminent future is trying to discern observational signatures of semi-classical effects at the horizon scale. And one of our best potential probes for these kinds of effects, and that can distinguish between different models of black holes, are the quasi-normal modes. So these are, you know, general black hole perturbations are described by a particular master equation for which part of the spectrum is this quasi-normal mode oscillation, which is like the ring down part of the signal when a black hole is perturbed. And the frequencies of these quasi-normal modes can be determined by the effective potential in this radial Schrodinger-like like equation. Now, this effective potential just depends on the form of the metric function, especially near the apparent horizon, because you work in this tortoise coordinate. So the region near the horizon, you stretch it all the way up to minus infinity. And this radial part of the wave function entirely determines a quasi-normal mode spectrum. So if you have a real black hole with a horizon, then the mode solutions you're looking for are the ones that are purely ingoing, because nothing can escape, and the ones that are purely outgoing at infinity. And you have some barrier around the light ring where the potential peaks. And so you select, you know, the perturbations which satisfy these boundary conditions, and you can compute the frequency. There are many different semi-analytical and numerical schemes for doing so. But these are the quasi-normal modes. Now, of course, if the object is not a black hole, if it's something different, then the potential will be very different, and the frequency of these quasi-normal modes has the potential to be very different. So, for example, if you have a horizonless object with some surface with non-zero reflectivity, then you can have all kinds of things happening. You can have backscattering. You can have echoes from reflections inside this potential well. The Schwarzschild potential vanishes at infinity and at the horizon, but other exotic models like the 2-2 hole can have a non-vanishing potential very close to the horizon. What we have is a form of the metric function and therefore the potential near the horizon, which is this region stretched out all the way to R stars minus infinity. We have a constraint on the form of that potential that needs to be satisfied if you want regularity at the apparent horizon and finite formation time. Right? So for a scalar field, I just give you the example of what our constraints look like for the potential. So the form of the potential for a given mode L must take on this value. These parameters E2 and E5-2 come from higher order terms in the energy momentum expansion, which need to be you need to solve for them, and they need to be consistent with the field equations. So you don't have an exact solution, but you have a constraint on the allowed form of the potential, at least for a scale. I give the example of scalar perturbations here. And so what I hope to be able to do is to at least, if not extract observational signatures, at least bound the allowed forms of the potential which enters into the quasi-normal mode spectrum. Now that quasi-normal mode spectrum is known to be very highly sensitive to the form of the potential. So one of the difficulties is that we have the form in the near horizon expansion, but this needs to somehow be matched with a regular Schwarzschild potential or something at some finite place. And very small perturbations in the potential, there is, I'm not an expert here, but there is quasi-normal mode instability where small fluctuations in the potential can dramatically alter the actual frequencies of the quasi-normal modes. But that is something that we're currently working on and hoping to make progress in, to try to extract some observational signatures, potentially, of semi-classical effects near the horizon. So it looks like right on time here for the summary. So what I want to say is that, what I hope to have conveyed at least, is that black holes are very interesting, both from a theoretical point of view, and by theoretical, I mean, in the context of five-dimensional black holes, supergravity solutions, things like this, are very important to study because they're interesting in their own right and give us insights into the quantum nature of gravity, but they also do have practical applications. And there's a lot of work to be done in understanding what these bulk features of these exotic solutions, what we can learn from them in holographic settings, especially in de Sitter space, where the field is rife with open problems and lots of different approaches. But also, real astrophysical black holes are something that we can now really start to see at the horizon scale, start to image, start to extract observational signatures. And so it's really important to understand if semi-classical effects significantly affect the dynamics, the formation, and observational signatures arising from compact objects that we believe to be our black holes in our current cosmology. So with that, I'll stop, and I will thank everyone for being here and invite some questions while we have time.
Thank you very much for this very interesting talk. So if there are any questions, either from here or from Zoom.
So Phil, maybe a comment so that I may call my friends at the HT become my enemies. I mean, you pointed out that the image as the best way we have to explore black holes. Let me push back on that. I think it's we have LIGO and Virgo and Kagan that are doing a far better job, right?
I agree. I hope I didn't say that, because I did not mean, if I did, I did not mean to say that that imaging is the best way. What I mean to say is that now we can, you know, at least image, you can see what you conceive of as a black hole, as a picture in the sky, but of course signatures from gravitational waves and so on, remain the most powerful signatures. I'm not an observationalist. Okay, so I don't want to get in a fight of whose technique and which signature is the most powerful or the most accurate, but we're in a multi-messenger era now, and so it's very important to understand how all of these signatures are affected by the presence of a horizon, its formation, and its semi-classical effects near the horizon.
Can I ask a question? Bill, do you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for your talk. You had a slide about this, EHT image that was a black hole zoo. I think that you mentioned that we cannot distinguish between different types of black hole models from the image. Is that right?
So you can, well, that's not entirely true, because of course, so here's my zoo, and here's the image. This image here.
Yeah, that's right, actually. So
I know there are some ongoing discussions and arguments about whether or not this image actually contains a light ring. Nonetheless, so this is clearly distinguishable from something like a large boson star or neutron star. But there are a variety, many of these compact objects, anisotropic black holes, and some of these fuzzballs and so on, especially the gravistars, you can construct them to be arbitrarily compact. Okay, so the image that you would, of the shadow of these objects are all the same, if sufficiently compact. And in that way, you cannot distinguish between them.
So, I mean, do you mean by using EHT or potentially? But because I think that we can distinguish, right? Because the structure of geodesics around these, all of these different types are different. So that means that near the horizon, or even, I mean, near the potentially, if there is any photon ring there or photosphere, then the structure of the geodesics are different, so we can see some deviations potentially, right?
In the general case, absolutely. All I'm saying is that there are certain models of these ultra-compact objects that have this clean photon sphere. So they're really, the dynamics all the way to within epsilon of the horizon is identical to a Schwarzschild or a Kerr black hole, including the geodesics and so on. Not all models, but some of them. Now, of course, some of these anisotropic stars and gravistar models, which can be arbitrarily compact, there's ongoing arguments about how they would actually form in a cosmological setting. Do they need unrealistic equations of state to form, and so on? So they may prove to be dynamically unstable and totally unviable. But the point is, just from the EHT observation alone, you cannot distinguish between them. That's why I'm interested in quasi-normal modes, especially because these are extremely sensitive to these kinds of features that you're talking about. Gravitational wave signatures are really, really where we can learn what the difference is.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, EHT cannot even constrain the black hole yet, so.
Yeah, I know. It's a nice picture, though.
Yes.
It's a nice picture, but I agree with you. I agree.
So. Okay. Are there any more questions?
No.
I can see.
No. I wanted to ask something from Luis.
I don't see any questions from Zoom either. So, if there are no more questions, I think we can proceed to thanking Phil once again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone. It was a pleasure.